Hello again, I'm Chris, I'm an alcoholic. happy Mother's Day to any mothers out there. And thank you for being here tonight. And thank you for allowing me to be here to share time with you here in week two of three. It's funny, when I got up here last week, I shared that when I was asked to participate in this commitment, I went through that alcoholic cycle of being really excited and flattered and then just straight up intimidated and worried like right before doing it. And then I was here and I really enjoyed the time that we had together last week. It was just a wonderful meeting, and I went home and I felt great. And so all this week I was like, I'm excited to go back and meet all these new friends that I made. And you know, in like typical alcoholic fashion, on like Thursday, suddenly the thought crossed my mind and it hits me like, well, what if you did such a bad job that no one shows up, you know? And so I did what I was taught to do in this program, right? I reminded myself of kind of where we left off last week on step three, right? I turned it over and I said a prayer and then I laughed about it, because the truth is that it has nothing to do with the result, you know? It's all about, I share my experience and we're really all just doing whatever. You know, I've turned things over to God to allow Him to control, and so I had the opportunity to laugh at it, but I didn't always feel that way. Because prior to going through 4 through 9 that we're going to talk about tonight, I was still a ball of nervousness and uneasiness, even in working steps 1 through 3 and starting to kind of hopefully grasp and develop this manner of living. The interesting thing, you know, about that I've found is how intimidated I was at the idea of going past 1, 2, and 3. And we talked a little bit about this last week when we talked about some of the themes that people share when they have this commitment. And I talked about things like desperation, inspiration, and perpetuation, right? The desperation that I found that helped propel me in to this program on July 7th of 2015, after having some exposure to this program and being in a lot of different facilities and rehabs and detoxes and places like that. But I came here on July 7, 2015, and I was desperate enough to grab a hold of this book and the process outlined in it as walked me through by a sponsor. And then the opportunity I've had to sponsor other men in the program and take them through this. But that desperation was what fueled me at first. And what was told to me was that you need to hang on to that desperation, but at some point you need to find inspiration to build upon that desperation. You need to find inspiration in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you need to find that inspiration, or at least the gentleman who told this to me told me that he found that inspiration in working steps 4 through 9. And I have too. And so that's what we're going to talk a little bit about, is those steps. And we'll get into some of the pages and reading here in just a second. But That's where I found that inspiration for me. Now, going into it, I jumped into step 4 fairly quickly, regardless of my level of intimidation, because I was just mostly scared of drinking again. Although I jumped into it fairly quickly, I had been at enough meetings to hear things like 1, 2, 3 and out. I had heard things like you need to get down to causes and conditions. I had heard things like you better do a fifth before you drink a fifth. And so I was like, I feel like I should probably do a fourth step. You know, like I was like, I feel like these things sound kind of important. And, you know, I was a little bit, mocus, as one of the old timers in my home group likes to call it. When I first came in, I just wasn't all there. But I remember thinking, this thing sounds important. And so here I am sitting there being told, you know, you need to get into this thing, and you're going to find inspiration in it, and it's going to have a lot to do with rigorous honesty. And I did not find those things to be very parallel at the time. I was like, I don't know how you think I'm going to feel any better by being honest about what I've done, right? Because most of my life I ran from those things. I thought the further I got from the things I had done and the defects of character, the further I got from those things, the better I might feel. And drinking was what always got me further from those things. And so I was reminded that I had made a deal in step 3 that I was going to turn my will over to the care of God as I understood Him, right? And that I was going to be provided not what I want, but only what I need. And that one of the things I needed to then do was going to be this fourth step. And so I'm going to read just from where it starts on page 63. and how it works, because it's pretty much how it was taught to me, which is, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless it once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. So, I'm told I need to do a personal house cleaning. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my mental house was not in order, my physical house was not in order, right? I lived in a, just in a world of mess. And now they're telling me that we're going to have to do a personal house cleaning. And I didn't understand that. I didn't understand, what do you mean it's blocking me? What do you mean that liquor is but a symptom? And it, you know, that's where I found out that removing the drink and not doing anything else, in my experience, will actually only make me crazier and more dangerous to myself. And that scared me. You know, and we learned a little bit about that when I talked about step one, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his or her mind, right? So now here I am, and my mind's starting to work again, right? Because I'm not filling it with booze every day. My mind's starting to work again, and it is making up for lost time. It is racing, right? It is coming up with every number of things that are terrible about me. It is coming up with all types of things. It's telling myself some truths I don't want to hear, and it's telling myself a lot of lies. Right, and that's where I'm stuck at that point. And so they tell me here in that next paragraph, therefore we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he can not fool himself about values. When I read that with a sponsor, it made sense to me in somewhat of a ironic way, because I had a job in college working at a liquor store. Like, big surprise. I had a job in college working at a liquor store, and the gentleman who I worked for was very meticulous about inventory. And I remembered that when we read this paragraph from my sponsor. I remembered this guy. He was very meticulous about inventory. And he was very meticulous about things being organized. And once a week, I would see him back there with a clipboard. And he'd be writing everything down. And he'd be taking things. And he'd be throwing them out or moving them to the back or moving them to the front. And he'd be saying, you know, the thing that propels my business is making sure that I am really, really sophisticated about taking inventory and understanding what's working and what's not. And that struck me. And it struck me in irony, right? Because I was, the guy owned a liquor store, right? Of all things, I was like, oh, it makes sense, because I worked for this guy who owned a liquor store, and he really seemed to know how to do inventory. And so I said, okay. I said, so then let's take this inventory thing, you know? And I didn't really know what that meant, but I knew that I had to do it. And I knew that I was willing to do it. But I was still a little bit intimidated. And that's when they hit me with the resentment word. Right at the bottom of the page here, it says, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And my first response was like, I thought alcohol destroyed more alcoholics than anything else. You know? And they said, no, these resentments are the number one offender. Right? They said, this is important. It's written in my book. My sponsor said, write "this is important" next to this phrase. And so I did, because I just did everything they told me. And so, you know, I didn't understand why. And I said, okay, so I can't have resentments. So what does that mean? How do I get rid of those things? And he said, you know, get your notebook. And we finished that third step prayer. And he immediately, when we stood up, he said, you know, the local CVS is right down the street. On your way home, buy a notebook. And he said, and in that notebook, open it up to a page. Make sure you leave enough room for four columns. And then he said, make a list. And, you know, he kept it pretty simple for me. He said, make a list of everybody you're angry at or has done you wrong or that you just don't like in general. You know, he said, any people, place, or thing. And I said, okay. Now, the interesting thing is at the same time, we were going through this book, and I had been, you know, I've been given the spoiler of spoiler alert of where to find some elements of step four in the big book. So he was very specific in saying, make this list one column, just the names, just the names. Now, I call my sponsor every single day. I call, and I was calling him every single day at that time as well. And every morning, we'd be hanging up the phone, and he'd say, just the names, just the names. You know, almost like he knew I was reading this, because if you read these columns, you can see what's coming a little bit, right? And so, and he said, just the names. And I said, okay. And I said, but I know what's going to happen, because I see some of these other columns. And he said, have you written any names yet? And I said, no. And he was like, what are you analyzing? You know? And then he said to me, he said, show me you mean business about step three by starting to write in step four. He said, I know that you're doing the right thing, and I know that you're trying, and I know that you mean business. He goes, but show me that you want to be here by putting pen to paper and starting to write those names. And I started to write those names. And I wrote those names down, and I just went through that list, right? I made that whole list. And then he said, okay, tell me why they're jerks. You know, it was as simple as that. You know, tell me why they're wrong. Tell me what they did to you. You know, and I made that list and I put those causes down. You know, and then he said, now follow page 65 and write down what that affects in you. Right? And he did that for two reasons. He told me that, you know, we follow the process outlined in this book, but at the same time, you also need to seek to identify. Right? And I was taught that the very first time I read Bill's story. He said, you have to seek to identify. You have to identify with the parts of the story that other people share where you may not identify with everything they say, but you have to seek to identify with the other things they say, because there are parallels there in our alcoholism. And so he said, read some of these and understand what it affected in them and start to list out what it affected in you. And I always think about this when we read this page is... Not long after that, when we went through my fourth step, and we'll keep talking about it in a second here, but not long after we went through my fourth step, we had the opportunity to go to one of these AA conventions, and we're walking around this AA convention, and there's a guy who's wearing this t-shirt, and it says, I'm happy, joyous, and free on the front. And it says dot, dot, dot. And I'm like, that means there's something on the back, right? So I run around to read the back of this guy's shirt. And he says, but Mr. Brown still deserved to have his ass kicked. And I laughed. And the reason I share that is because when I laughed, I realized that I knew what something in the fourth step meant. Right? I laughed because I was like, I had this realization because I said, oh my gosh, like, that's in the fourth step in the big book. And I know it because that means I've read it and I've done a fourth step. And it was a little bit like where I was like, well, heck, I might be in AA. You know, I might actually be doing this thing a little bit. But I still remember that moment. And I still remember that was one of the first moments where I really felt like I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. For some reason, and it's only my experience, you know, I had gone to a lot of meetings early on in my sobriety where I was at that point of working a fourth step. I had gone to a lot of meetings. I started to get to know people's names, right? Which is always the hardest part because when you're new, it seems like everybody knows your name, but you don't know all of theirs because there's 1,000 people saying hello to you. And when they're like, hello, Chris, and I'm like, hey, man, you know, like, it's awkward and uncomfortable. But at this point, I had started to get to know some names and some faces, and I was calling people on a regular basis. But I personally didn't necessarily fully feel a part of just yet until I felt like I could say that I was working a fourth step. And, you know, when I was writing that fourth step, I guess I could say not everything I needed to know, because that's probably a little bit arrogant or too all-inclusive, but a large part of what I learned about the fourth step all took place on page 66. And I'll start with a couple things on there, and I'll read through it. But at the very top, it says, to conclude that others were wrong were as far as most of us ever got. And that was absolutely true, right? I knew every reason why every person in my life had done something wrong to me, right? And I remembered every little thing about how they had wronged me. I remembered every single instance of things where I just didn't like how they treated me. I remembered all of those things very, very clearly, you know. And when it goes on in that next paragraph where it says, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. And then here it says, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? That's where I realized that I spent a lot of time obsessing over things that I felt people had done to wrong me. And they continued going about their life. And I ate up so many hours. And I don't know about anybody else, but when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like life had passed me by. I felt like I sat on my couch drinking and watched everybody else's life progress. And social media has a way of really doing that to you pretty well if you're going to allow it, right? So I'd sit there drinking and watch everyone else's life progress. I'd watch them go about their lives and have other good things happen. You know, and I'd sit there and I realized, man, I spent a lot of hours wrapped up in drinking at people, drinking over people, drinking under people, drinking for all different reasons about people and what they had done to me. And now you tell me that these things, which mostly were what fueled me in my drinking years, like I felt powerful when I was angry at you. I felt like I could, you know, move mountains if I was angry enough at somebody, right? And then I find out that this superpower of resentment that I thought was so helpful to me was one of the critical reasons why I'd continued to drink. I didn't really know how I was supposed to handle that. But I knew that, number one, I had only looked at why other people were wrong. And number two, I had spent a lot of time doing it. And it talks here on the page about the fatal progression that happens here. And then, as I start to look at myself, and I start to think, where have I gone wrong? Where have I hurt these people? I start to realize this pattern, right? This pattern of expectations that I've put on people. This pattern of always feeling insecure. This pattern of wanting to place all of my self-worth in what somebody else thought of me. You know, and there was countless times where it was just the same repeatable pattern over and over. And that was probably the first thing I learned about myself, is that when given the opportunity, I will place how I feel about myself in any given moment on how you, based on how you feel about me. Right? And that was true in all of my relationships. Growing up, like, were parents telling me I did a good job? Great. Then that means that I'm happy with myself, right? Do my friends like me? Then great, that means I'm happy about myself. Relationships, I would get into relationships, right? And it was constantly, give me validation, give me validation, give me validation, right? And when that person wouldn't give me any validation, it was like, why aren't you supporting me, you know? Or even when they would continue to do it, and it says it, you know, they'll either continue to do it, but at some point they revolt, right? And we find ourselves hurt because this person is like, I'm not here to support you. I'm just trying to support myself. You know, and I had never looked at it that way. So when I saw that pattern, it was the first fact that I had learned about myself, right? That I could no longer place those expectations on other people, right? And it talks in here about placing those expectations and needing a higher power to lean on for that support, right? People are imperfect. You know, you can't expect somebody to do all those things and just always be there and do every single thing you want. You know, and then I thought about, like, how many people I was mad at or upset with because they didn't do what I wanted, but I never once thought about what they needed, right? And those are two very different things. Like, there were people in my life at that time who I wanted them to do certain things, but, you know, they also needed me in a very real way. And I held that support from them only based on whether or not they were giving me what I wanted, right? And that's not really how it works, I found out. Now, one of the interesting things about resentments that I was taught was how you look at somebody or how you just handle or navigate having a resentment. You know, it's probably best described when I read it from the bottom here of page 66. It says, we realized that the people who had wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. And the next page, though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Right, and then it gets into the four-step prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. So a couple things I was taught from this paragraph was when I get a resentment, and I do this on like a daily basis. Like I'll have somebody in my life who says something that upsets me, or I don't like it, or whatever the case may be, and the first alarm goes off, which is like, well, I'm not allowed to get a resentment, right? Like, I'm angry right now, but I'm about to get on this express lane of the road to resentment, so I'm going to have to do something about this. So I put him through the columns, man. That's, you know, and there are times, and, you know, whether it's right or wrong, there are times, and sometimes it's in a work setting or something like that, I'll be sitting there having a conversation with somebody, and I'm like, this person has no idea that right now I'm putting him through the columns in my head. Right? Why are you making me, you know, why am I angry? I'm angry at you. I know that. Like, why am I angry? Because you're not doing things my way. You know, what is that affecting in me? And by the end of the conversation, I'm perfectly calm and everything's fine. You know, because I've put them through those columns. But at one point in that stage, I then have to look at somebody and sometimes say, maybe this person is spiritually sick. Right? Or how am I treating this person? Would I treat this person as I cheerfully would treat a sick friend? Thing I had to really understand about that is that I can't use that type of phrase as a way to belittle that person or put them down, right? We're going to talk about things, you know, in defects, we talk about things like character assassination, right? And whether I am putting that person down outwardly to a bunch of other people or whether I'm just putting them down in my head, it's not right, right? So when somebody upsets me and I say, well, this is a sick person, how can I be helpful to them? I can't use it to actually try and elevate myself to some sort of superior level above them, right? I should only be reaching my hand out to them. And that's how I need to look at it. But I was warned about making that mistake because they said, you're going to start to walk around and have people that you're angry with and be like, oh, well, they're just less than me. And they're like, it's not that they're less than you. It's that you have to look at them that they might be as spiritually sick as you, more than likely you're more sick than them. And that's what somebody told me. But they said you need to look at it in that way because it's the only way that any empathy and compassion comes out and allows you to deal with that type of situation. There was somebody in one of the meetings that I was going to when I was new. And, you know, I said to my sponsor, I just don't like this person. You know? And he's like, oh, you got a resentment. And I'm like, no, no, no. It's not a resentment. I just don't like him. You know, and he's like, you had any good reason for it? And I'm like, no, I don't have any good reason for it. And he's like, let's talk about that. And we talked a little bit about it. And he said to me, every single meeting that you go to that this person is at, I want you to offer to get them a cup of coffee. And I want you to do it for the next 2 weeks. And that was like one of the first times I really said, like, am I really that desperate to be here? You know, like, I did it, you know, And I became good friends with that person, you know? And we're not best of friends or something like that. But what I will tell you is that I don't look at this person and think that person bothers me anymore. I just look at them as another person in AA who I'm fortunate to know. And I've learned quite a lot from listening to him share in meetings, right? I needed to do some of those humbling things in order to get past my own judgments and see what other people were truly like. Now, the one thing I want to go back to and mention in here is a little bit of some of the inspiration that I found in the fourth step in places where I didn't think I would. So at the bottom of the page, it says, did we not set the ball rolling ourselves? Right? What was my part in it when I had these resentments? You know? And that part's not in the three columns that they show you in the book. Right? That's not the part they tell you about. Now, you read it and you see it in here, but that's not in the columns, right? And so my sponsor was like, well, how'd you set the ball rolling? What was your part in this? And when I looked at my patterns as to why I acted certain ways, and I looked at what my part was in some of these things, that's where I found some inspiration because I said, wow, I'm not happy with how I conducted myself, but I'm pretty darn happy that I finally know something about myself. You know, because it was the first time I had really seen a picture of myself. It was the first time I had come face to face with some of the things I had done. And I just find that a really interesting place to find some of that inspiration because it's a difficult thing to see. It's a difficult thing to cop to. But when I did, I felt like, man, this really is the first time in my life that I've found out something about who and what I am at this moment in time or at those moments in times when I treated this person that way. And it also inspired me to take any opportunity I could to change. Now, on page 68, in the middle of the page, is where I felt like they really tied in a lot of step three and leveraged myself agreeing that I was all in on 1, 2, and 3 into helping me get into 4 and 5, because it says, perhaps there is a better way, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, he does enable us to match calamity with serenity. So the reason I say I felt like it tied in together is because I said, okay, got these resentments, listed them out, agreed that what it affected in me, so I identified some of these things and I saw my part in it. I understand how to handle resentments when I go through those columns with somebody. I understand how to treat that person when I'm having those resentments. And I do it enough times, you know, I work that muscle enough where I get in a place where it all happens pretty smoothly and I'm able to go through life not being a mean person to people and not getting set off and in somewhat of a serene mood, right? But how am I supposed to have that on an ongoing basis, right? I can't always just count on myself being perfect all the time, and I'm certainly not perfect all the time. But where do I get some sort of strength to continue to do that, right? And they say, well, don't forget what you just said in step three, right? The basis of relying upon God, turning it over and trusting God rather than trusting myself, right? Asking what he would have me do. Admitting that every situation that I'm in, whether I like it or not, is the specific position that he's put us in this day. And then they hit you, you know, then they hit you with the other one that I didn't see coming at the bottom of page 68. And I'm just going to read the very first three words and then go into the next page. It says, now about sex. And I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, I thought we covered all the resentment stuff. Like, you know, this wasn't part of the inventory that my old boss took. Like, I was like, what do you mean? What about sex? And on page 69, it says here, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom have we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So the reason that that part stood out to me is because, you know, when I find out that I have to tell you about all of my fears, I'm okay with that, right? So resentments and my fears. And now I tell you that sex is part of the inventory, and I'm like, that's not happening, you know? And it's all consent prior to investigation, right? Because when I see those three words on page 68 and it says, now about sex, I interpret this as somebody wants me to make a list of anybody that I've ever been intimate with. And why do they need to know that? You know? And if I'm being very candid, there are some that I might not even remember. So why does it even matter? And that's what I tell myself. You know? And that's and I can spiral real quick, right? I can be like, all of you AA people are creeps. Why do you want a list of everyone I've ever been with? You know, all that kind of weird stuff. This paragraph changed my opinion about that. Because this paragraph is not saying, tell us who you slept with, right? This paragraph is saying about sex relations and even relationships overall. It's saying, why don't you be honest about what type of person you were as a partner to somebody else? Why don't you be honest about whether or not you were with somebody out of convenience? You were with somebody because maybe they were the person who did all the validating you wanted in every single minute and every time, but maybe that was the only reason you were with them. Did you arouse jealousy for no reason just to make yourself feel better? Mm-hmm. Right? What type of person or partner were you? You know, they talk about instincts a lot in step four, not only in here, but when they talk about it in things like the 12 and 12, right? And they talk about instincts, right? And that's one of those instincts, the instincts to try and find another person to be with, right? And I find out in this list that if I don't find a way to change that, I am not going to be a healthy person to be with. And I had to look at that because I had to understand that simply stopping drinking was not going to make me some very attractive person to be with, right? If I were going to want to find anybody in the future. And so that helped me tremendously because when I first saw those three words, I panicked and I was against that idea. And then when I understood what they were getting at, right? And thinking about the ideal future safe or future state and how can we not be selfish and we must be willing to grow toward it. You know, these are the things that I realized, okay, I'm going to have to clear some of this out of the way in order to really be anybody of value is what I felt like. The other thing that I also liked here at the end of this in 70 and 71 is on 70, it says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. Right? And I don't know why that line made it make so much sense, but like what I've noticed like when I was early on in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I had to get on board with the idea that helping somebody else was almost always going to be the solution to whatever problem I was obsessing over at that time. Right? So when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm a single man and I'm thinking immediately once I start to get sober that, well, I'm going to be alone forever because nobody's going to date me as an alcoholic, right? Or how am I going to drink at my daughter's wedding, right? Like, I'm single, no relationship, hadn't had any relationship in the 5 years prior to coming to AA, right? And all of a sudden I'm worried about what I'm going to do at my fictional daughter's wedding. And, you know, it's how my mind works, right? And it occurred to me in that moment, maybe I'll just pick up the phone and call one of the guys in my home group and ask him if he's having a good day, right? Or I knew that another member of my home group was in his backyard moving some, I don't remember what he was moving, he was doing some construction in his backyard, and I said, maybe I'll just go over there and ask him if he wants help for 2 or 3 hours, right? Leaning into helping somebody else, whether it be diving deep into this book or just helping him move some rocks in his backyard, will get me out of that cycle that I'm in. You know, and for whatever reason, that line always helps remind me of that on a larger scale within Alcoholics Anonymous. So at the end of this chapter, right, what have I learned? What am I inspired by? I am now armed with the facts about myself, or as they say, I've digested some big chunks of truth about myself. I have a daily way to handle when I'm going through resentments, and that it was nice to know something about myself, right? I'm inspired about that. On chapter 6, it says, you know, if we skip this step, we may not overcome drinking. And I'm just going to read this one part on 73 here. It starts in the middle of the page about they took inventory all right, but they hung on to some of the worst item in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all of their life story. So now I have to go and tell somebody all the things that I've done wrong. And I have to be honest, or as honest as I can be at that time. So, I'm just going to read the larger part of page 75 and talk about the fifth step here. It starts with, we pocket our pride. So it says, we pocket our pride and go for it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken the step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone in perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling of the drink problem has disappeared. Will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from ourselves, we turn the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. For we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Right, so this talks a little bit about, at least for me, what my entire progression through the fifth step was, which was when I finished writing that fourth step, and I finished reviewing it with a sponsor. We were sitting on a beach in Atlantic Islands, and you know, I knew it was coming, right? I knew the fifth step's coming because you know everybody talks about it. And one of the things that worries me sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous is how scary we make the fourth and the fifth steps sound to newcomers. No one made it sound scary to me. I made it sound scary to myself. But I do worry that sometimes we make them worried about what the fourth and the fifth step is, because for me, it's where I found real freedom. And I worry that sometimes we intimidate people with it. So he had a very good way of getting me over any concerns I might have had on that front. We went through the fourth step. He closed my notebook. He put it down and he looked at me and he said, okay, so when you put your head on the pillow at night, what are the thoughts that race through your head and the memories that you can't get rid of? And I just let it all out. You know, like, I thought we were going to ease into it. I thought it was going to be like, you know, tell me about the candy bar you stole when you were a kid from a store, and then we'll get into the real heavy stuff, you know? But he said it that way, and he said it in such a smooth way that it was, we pocket our pride and go for it. I just let it all out, and I just leaned right into it. And I started with the heavy stuff, you know? And then he said some stuff, right? And he told me some things that he had done. He put skin in the game, right? He told me some of those things. And I, you know, when we went back and forth and we talked for a while, you know, and at the end of it, he said, you know, I hope you know you're not a bad person. He goes, you might be dumb. He's like, but you're not a bad person, you know? And he goes, and the best part is you have the opportunity to never be that person again. Now, that paragraph, that first one of those two that I read, it can be a little bit, in my experience or opinion or whatever you want to call it, it can make it sound a little bit extravagant because it says, you know, our fears fall from us, the nearness of our Creator. Like it can make it sound very white lightish, right? And sometimes it's not like that. And that wasn't necessarily my experience either. I only realized how spiritual my fifth step was until I was like a month or two removed from it, and I looked back on it and realized how different I felt from that moment forward. But I didn't realize it in the moment. And the funny thing is when it talks about returning home, I was told, go home, sit quietly for an hour, read these steps, tell me if you're still all in, right? And I went home, and I sat down, and I sat quietly, no TV, right? No, you know, flipping through Facebook, none of that kind of stuff, right? I sat down quietly for an hour, and about 30 minutes in, I fell asleep. And I woke up, and I was panicked. Right, it was a Saturday afternoon, it was 2 p.m., I had fallen asleep in the middle of the day, right after I was told to sit quietly for an hour and think about everything we had done, and I was like, I totally broke it. I broke my fifth step, I ruined it, everything's terrible. You know. And then I talked to a few people, and they were like, well, when was the last time, when you weren't drunk, that you were able to sit down and just quiet your mind enough to fall asleep in the middle of a day? And I said, I can't remember that. They said, why? And I said, they're like, what about all the other weekends since you've been coming around? And I said, well, most of the time I've just been busying myself with things to not think about drinking. And they said, well, maybe it's a spiritual experience that you sat down and you were able to quiet your mind enough just in thinking about AA to simply lay down and take a nap. And that's where I realized that my mind had changed a little bit. And then he said to me, now tell me what you left out. You know, because there's always one or two things, at least in my experience, that I left out, and I told him those things. And we got right into 6 and 7, and it's right there on page 76, and I'm going to read them both because it's just the only two paragraphs right here in it. Step 6, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? We still cling to something we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. When ready, we say something like this: my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. So, the biggest thing I was taught was don't be fooled when that you see there's only two paragraphs about these steps in the big book. They're just about as subtle a foe as alcohol is, right? Because I learned that although they only have these two paragraphs, that these character defects and asking for help from a higher power were going to be a big part of my life going forward. And it was worrisome and helpful. Because I walked into a Wednesday night meeting at my home group. It was timed perfectly because it was shortly after I had finished the fourth and the fifth step, and my sponsor and I had read these two, and I didn't really grasp the idea of, like, the steps are no longer checklists, right? You don't check these off, right? These are things that you do every single day for the rest of your life. Like, they're not just things that you do and then get rid of forever and ever. But I sat down in this 12 and 12 meeting on a Wednesday night, fresh off a fourth and a fifth step, figured 6 and 7, small paragraphs, really easy. I'm going to cruise through this so that I can gain steam for 8 and 9. And we opened up that 12 and 12, and the first line says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I'm pretty sure out loud said, you got to be kidding me. Because I said, what do you mean? I was like, I thought these were supposed to be the easy ones, right? And then I said, well, what do I have to do? Because I had just come from a place where I could, I guess in a very tangible way, show that I had completed a fourth step, because there's things written on a piece of paper, and a fifth step because I had told things to a sponsor. And now 6 and 7, I'm like, you know, I thought, how are we supposed to get all of my defects together and lure them into one room, put them in a net, and give them to God? Right? And then I'm never going to have them again, you know, and everything's going to be fine. And it was told to me that said, no, this is the point where you realize that this is going to be an everyday practice. Mm-hmm. Right? And they said, and what's going to happen if you continue to work this program is you're going to realize these character defects more and more when they pop up. And the longer that you come here, the less you're going to like when you see them pop up. And you're going to have to do something with them. And when you do, you're going to have to ask your higher power for help with those defects. And then they also said, you can't hide in your defects either. And what they meant by that was, I can't continue to allow a character defect to operate in my life and just say, oh, look at that character defect back again. Like, look how cute it is. But it's okay because I recognized it, you know? I actually have to attempt to ask God for help to do something with it. And that's what it means to work the step, right? And I've heard people use analogies like your defects are like whack-a-mole, right? Always trying to knock them down and those things like that. But there's a lot of times where most days I just say the 7-step prayer and say, hey, God, I'm not sure when the next one's coming up, but I'm hoping that you have my back when it does. And when I notice it, I'm going to admit it immediately and I'm going to ask you for help with it. But more than any other step, 6 and 7 are the ones that I have to continue to work on a daily basis, at least in my own experience. Now we got through those paragraphs and then we get right into 8 and 9. Now with step 8, I was grateful to find out that those things are separate steps, and I didn't understand why, right? Because I thought, well, you know, 8 says that I'm willing to make amends and 9 says that I go make amends. Why don't I just combine them and start saying sorry to everybody I see, you know? And once again, I was wrong. I mean, I'm wrong about every single initial thing that I had with the steps when I came in, right? I was like, you read the step and I'll tell you what it means. And they're like, yeah, you can tell us and all that worldly experience you have, you know? So, you know, that was my initial interpretation. Was like, why do I need those two separate things? So the biggest thing for me that made a difference in between these steps, because I'm going to read some things here and It does going to feel like I combine them a little bit, so that's why I'm giving a little bit of a disclaimer ahead of that to say that I understand that they're separate steps. Is the biggest thing that I found in step 8 is that I had to get my index cards, and I had to write names on each one of those index cards of the people that I've harmed. And then I had to become willing to make amends to them all. And what I was taught is that the willingness for me to make amends in step 8 means that whatever name I'm looking at on that index card, no matter what they say to me when I go to make that amends, I've already forgiven that person for anything that I still might be harboring that they have done to me, real or fancied. Right? So if I have, you know, my mom on an amends card, right? Have I forgiven her for anything that I may have blamed her for? Or if she had done anything to me, have I forgiven her for that? And that's how I knew that I was willing to make amends to that person, if I could say yes to what was on those cards. And that would become critically important for me, because if I go to make that amends, and it talks about it in here, right? We're not going to fight back. We're only going to keep our side of the street clean. You know, we're just there to do our part. Like, that all sounds really nice. But if you're not totally clean with how that person, how you feel about that person and how they've treated you, they might say something where I might turn around and I might be like, well, what about this stuff that you did, right? And I want to talk about how you made a mistake. And then all of a sudden, it's, I thought you were here making amends to me. And, you know, the thing can go sideways real quick if I haven't completely forgiven that person for anything that I felt they had done to me before I go in and make amends to them. And I don't go there and say, and I know you hurt me, but I've forgiven you. I do that forgiveness all within myself. And I have to clear that out of myself. And then I'm willing to make amends. The other big thing with when I went into this immense process, before I read a couple of these things here in the paragraphs, is going to be the importance of speaking with a sponsor or somebody who I trusted before I went into these. Because I was told, get your index cards and write down the names of anybody that you've harmed. Now, I get my index cards and I write all the names down and I show up at the local coffee place to meet my sponsor to talk about it. And I've got my index cards in my order of importance. And they're all based on the order of importance that I have in front of me. It's really just mostly based on the people that I want to know that I'm doing good now. Right? Like, I want to go and make amends to friends and to exes and to anybody else who I want them to say pretty much, hey, everybody, come see how good I look, right? That's how I want to do it. My family, the ones who deserve the amends the most, are at the bottom of the pile, right? And my sponsor looks at this list of index cards and he changes the order completely. He says, this is the order that we're going to go out and do this in. You know, and at the bottom of here, it says, probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel different about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. And what he said to me was, you're not going there to tell them how great you are. You're going there to make amends for something that you did wrong. And if simply is just righting a wrong what you need to do, then that's what you're going to do. You're not going to preach to them about a spiritual experience that you've had. You're not going to preach to them about how sober you are or how many meetings you attend. There are people where their lives are far better off without you, but you've done things that you need to, you know, make restitution for. And he was like, so you're going to get in there and you're going to get out and you're not going to preach to them. You're not going to go to somebody who spent a lot of time trying to save your life financially and emotionally, who has now gotten their life on better footing and is probably better without you getting in the way. But they still want that money, right, that you owe them. So you're going to go and make that amends and you're going to get out of their life because that's the best thing you can do for them. And he pointed out to me on page 77, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That's where I was told the result does not matter, right? I grew up playing competitive sports. I work in a competitive job. I like scoreboards. I like to know when who's winning. I like to know who's losing. I don't even mind if I'm the winner or the loser. I just like to know that there was a decision made, right? And then you tell me that I'm going in to make this amends, and this is not a, will you forgive me? Yes, I will. No, I won't, right? I'm told that the result doesn't matter. It's one of the main times that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the only places in my experience where all of the success and the triumph comes in the effort. It does not come in the result. And when I learned that, I realized I can go out and do these things. I don't have to worry about what the result is because it doesn't really matter. And then I was told, and this is the part that scared me, was, and one of the main reasons you're doing this is so that you can help someone else do it. And I said, I totally forgot about that. I'm going to have to help other people, you know? But they said you can't sit across from somebody and not help them if you haven't done it yourself. So the last two things that I'll share here as we go through is on page 78, it says, most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we are trying to do, we make no bones about drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism. On theory, it may cause financial harm. Approaching this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go. We're liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. So there was somebody in my life years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, there was somebody in my life who supported me financially when I was in rehab and hospitals and other places like that. And, you know, I pretty much skipped on them and skipped town and hadn't spoken to them in 5 years. And my sponsor pulled that card and he put it right at the top of the list. You know, he said, we're going to pay our debts. Now, the very first person I had to make amends to, or I had the opportunity to make amends to in Alcoholics Anonymous, was my mother. My mother's sober 26 years. She's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to this day, I'll tell you, she let me off easy. Right? I got one of those, just keep doing what you're doing, right? And I continue to just keep doing what I'm doing. I spent Mother's Day with her today, and it was a gift of the program. It's one of the best days that we've had. And we've had a lot of wonderful days together. But the next one on that list was paying that money. And he said, you know, we're not going to run from this. And I remember saying, well, I don't want to pay them in pieces because I don't want them to know that I don't have the money to pay them all up front right now. So I don't want to tell them that I'm going to pay them until I have the money. And he was like, stop, stop, stop. He's like, you're going to approach this person and you're going to make the money. You're going to pay them in whatever payment plan that you can, and you're going to go to them. 4 days after I told him that I didn't want to pay that person in pieces, and I was like, okay, I guess I'll do it. I had still waffled on it. 4 days after I made that declaration to him, I won an award at work, and they gave me almost the exact amount of money that I owed this person.
That's great.
It was an award for performance. And I was only 6 months sober at the time. So everybody in AA was like, imagine you hadn't been drinking for a year, you would have done great. You know, but it was almost for the exact amount of money that I owed this person. So the next day I called them. And I had this decision tree, I called it, right? Because this person had moved on with their life. They had other wonderful things going on in it. And I wasn't there to disrupt it. I was only there to make good on what I had wronged. So I wasn't sure they were going to see me. And so I said, hey, you know, this is Chris. Before you hang up, I just need you to listen for 10 seconds, please. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm working the 12 steps of the program. And one of them is, and I'm going this fast because I know they're going to hang up any second. One of them is step 9. I need to make an amends. You know, will you give me the opportunity to speak with you? And they said, yes. And I said, so they say that I should be making these amends face to face. And this person said, absolutely not. And I said, okay. And I had this little piece of paper. If they say yes, say this. If they say no, say this. Okay, they said no, won't see you. Okay, now we're doing this on the phone. And I said, you know, I just want to let you know that I'm trying to do the right thing, but I said, I'm not here to get in your way. I know you have a wonderful life going on, but I do. And they said, but you do owe me money. And I said, yes. And they said, you know, pay me as ever much or as little as you can. And I said, I can pay you all in full. Just tell me where to send it. They gave me an address to send it to at their office because they did not want me to know where they live, which they are perfectly willing to do that. But it wasn't the easiest amends in the world, and not for the financial reason. It was not the easiest amends in the world because that person was not happy to hear from me and was not very interested in continuing the conversation, and ultimately did not want me to know where they lived because of the experience that they had with me. If I had not listened to what they wrote in this book and forgiven any wrongs I felt they had done to me in the 8th step before getting into the 9th step, I wouldn't have been capable of having that conversation. And I went to the bank, and I got the cashier's check, and then I did it certified mail, because then I started to panic, thinking it wouldn't get there, and somebody would steal it, so then they had to sign for it, and it was the whole thing, right? But the point is that I found an incredible amount of freedom in righting the wrong, because I cannot change what I did or how I treated somebody, right? But I found the inspiration in having the opportunity to clean up my side of the street and right that wrong. And that's a lot of the opportunities that I've had in working the amends in these steps. The last one I'll share here before we close up, sorry to go over a little over the time, but the last one that I'll share here is I mentioned that I had a lot of acquaintances at the top of my list in making those amends, and that, you know, my sponsor talked about changing those up and making those to family and to other people. There's a line in here, and in the interest of time, I won't read the whole thing. But it talks about a long period of reconstruction ahead, a remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill at all. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. So the reason I say that is because I made an amends to a family member who I love dearly, who's close to me. It's my sister. And I made an amends to them. And the amends went fine. And it was very similar, like, just keep doing what you're doing. But that paragraph showed me that it taught me that people learn with their eyes. That's what I was told. People learn with their eyes, not with their ears. And so while they might have said, okay, great, thanks for making the amends, they were going to be listening and paying attention to what I did. And it was about, let me think here. 5 or 6 years, 5 years, excuse me, after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, before they were willing to give me the code to their home to enter it unsupervised. Because I used to have the code to their home, and I did plenty of things that I shouldn't be allowed to be in there supervised for. Right? But I remember when I made that amends and I said, it doesn't feel like everything's perfect right away. And I was pointed to that paragraph. Like, think about how long and how much you put these people through. I nearly died in their home on 2009. I was dragged out of there by the police department with alcohol poisoning. And here I am, sober for, at the time, like 7 months. Like, I can't believe that they won't let me in their house, you know? And I was pointed to that paragraph. You're going to have to put in the time. You're going to have to put in the work. You're going to have to show up, suit up, be around, be present. They tell you they want to see you every week, see them every week. They tell you they want to hear from you, they're going to hear from you. Show up and help them out. I did enough of those things that all of a sudden one day they said, yeah, can you just put that in the garage for me? Here's the code. And I was like, this is monumental. And they're like, you know, did you do it yet? You know, like they didn't think much about it. But at the time it was monumental for me. And I share that story because I had forgotten about how much I really obsessed about that until the moment when it happened. Because I was focused on just doing the next right thing that you guys told me to do. And that's why I talk a lot about the inspiration that I find in working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because moments like that remind me that somebody else who's very close to me and a very good judge of knowing my history and who I am has seen a fundamental change in who I am as a person, right? And that's pretty inspiring because they see me as somebody they trust, when for a long time I was somebody who they were worried about and feared and they couldn't trust. And I'll never see the change in myself first. We always see the change in others before we see it in ourselves. We can't see the picture when we're in the frame, is what I was told. Right? It's going through this process and doing these things where I find the inspiration of just being a different person. Right? And then they say to me and my home group, we're really glad that you're changing. We're really glad you're doing so well. What are you doing to maintain it every day? And most importantly, what are you doing to help somebody else? Because you will lose this thing if you don't help somebody else immediately. And that's what we're going to talk about a little bit next week in perpetuation, I guess. So I'm really sorry that I went over the time, but thank you guys for letting me share.